I perceived there within a tent of purest white silk, although to describe it thus is to defame it. This was no earthly silk, but a higher, more perfect variety, of which our silk is a laughable imitation, within which a great feast was about to unfold, and on a raised dais sat our host, a magnificent king, and next to the king's place sat an empty chair, a grand chair, upholstered with gold, if gold were spun of light, and each particle of that light exuded joy and the sound of joy, and that chair was intended, I understood, for our red-bearded friend. Christ was that king within. Christ was also, I now saw, that seated prince emissary at the table, in disguise or secondary emanation. I cannot explain it. The red-bearded man passed through the diamond doors in his characteristic rolling gait, and the doors closed behind him. Never in my nearly 80 years of life on earth had I experienced a greater or more bitter contrast between happiness, the happiness I felt even glimpsing that exalted tent from such a great distance, and sadness. I was not within the tent, and even a few seconds without seemed a dreadful eternity. I began to weep, as did my funeral-suited friend from Pennsylvania. But his weeping, at least, was leavened with anticipation, for he was next, his separation from that place to be that much briefer than mine. He stepped forward. "How did you live?" asked the being on the right. "Tell it truthfully," the other said, as from either side they gently touched their heads to his. They recoiled, then withdrew to two gray stone pots set down on either side of that grand hall, into which they vomited twin streams of brightly colored fluid. The small versions of themselves rushed to bring towels, upon which they wiped their mouths. "May we confirm?" said the one on the right. "Wait, what did you see?" he said. "Is there some..." But it was too late. The being on the right sang a single ominous note, and out came the several smaller versions of himself, but crippled and grimacing, bearing between them a feces-encrusted mirror. The being on the left sang his somber, jarring note, and several smaller versions of himself tumbled out, rolling forth via a series of spastic, clumsy gymnastic movements that were somehow accusatory, bearing the scale. "Quick check," the Christ Prince said sternly. "I'm not sure I completely understood the instructions," the funeral-suited man said. "If I might be allowed to..." The being on the right held the mirror up before the funeral-suited man, and the being on the left reached into the funeral-suited man's chest with a deft and aggressive movement, extracted the man's heart, and placed it on the scale. "Oh, dear," said the Christ emissary. A sound of horrific opprobrium and mourning echoed all across that kingdom. The diamond doors flew open. I blinked in disbelief at the transformation within. The tent was no longer of silk, but flesh, speckled and pink with spoiled blood. The feast was not a feast, but rather, on long tables inside, numerous human forms were stretched out in various stages of flaying. The host was no king, no Christ, but a beast, bloody-handed and long-fanged, wearing a sulfur-colored robe, bits of innard speckling it. Visible therein were three women and a bent-backed old man, bearing long ropes of their own intestines. Terrible. But most terrible of all was the way they screeched with joy as my funeral-suited friend was dragged in among them, and the way that poor fellow kept smiling, as if attempting to ingratiate himself with his captors, listing the many charitable things he had done back in Pennsylvania, and the numerous good people who would vouch for him, especially in the vicinity of Wilkes-Barre, if only they might be summoned. Even as he was wrestled over to the flaying table by several escort beings, apparently constituted entirely of fire, such that, when they grabbed him, their searing touch instantaneously burning away his funeral suit, his pain was so great that he could no longer struggle or move at all, except his head turned briefly in my direction, and his eyes, horror-filled, met mine. The diamond doors crashed shut. It was my turn. "How did you live?" asked the being on the right. Seen from this close, he took on the aspect of Mr. Prindle, from my old school, whose thin lips used to purse sadistically as he flogged us, precisely. "Tell it truthfully," the other warned, in the voice of my sodden Uncle Jean, always so harsh with me, who had once, drunk, hurled me down the stairs of the granary. As from either side they bumped their heads to mine. I endeavored to let them fully in, to hold nothing back, to hide nothing, to provide as true an accounting of my life as was in my power. They recoiled even more fiercely than before, and the smaller versions of themselves rushed forward with even larger gray stone pots, into which my yellow-footed judges began to vomit spasmodically. I looked at the Christ emissary. His eyes were cast down. "May we confirm?" said the being on the left. From the right came the feces mirror, from the left the scale. "Quick check," the Christ emissary said. I turned and ran. I was not pursued. I do not know why. They could have caught me easily. Of course they could. As I ran, whips of fire flew past my ears, and I understood, from whispers delivered therefrom, the whips to be saying, "Tell no one about this, or it will be worse upon your return." Upon my return, I thought, and a splinter of terror entered my heart and is lodged there still. I ran for days, weeks, months, back up the trail, until one night, stopping to rest, I fell asleep and woke up here again, and grateful, so deeply grateful. I have been here since and have, as instructed, refrained from speaking of any of this to anyone. What would be the point? For any of us here, it is too late for any alteration of course. All is done. We are shades, immaterial. And since that judgment pertains to what we did or did not do in that previous material realm, correction is now forever beyond our means. Our work there is finished. We only await payment. I have thought long and hard on what might have caused me to merit that terrible punishment. I do not know. I did not kill, steal, abuse, deceive, was not an adulterer, always tried to be charitable and just, believed in God, and endeavored at all times, to the best of my ability, to live according to His will, and yet was damned. Was it my occasional period of doubt? Was it that I sometimes lusted? Was it my pride when I had resisted my lust? Was it the timidity I showed by not following my lust? Was it that I wasted my life fulfilling outward forms? Did I, in my familial affairs, commit some indiscretion, oversight, or failing that now escapes my memory? Was it my hubris, utter, in believing that I, living there, confined by mind and body, could possibly imagine what was going to occur here? Was it some sin so far beyond my ability to comprehend it that even now I remain unaware of it, ready to commit it again? I do not know. Many times I have been tempted to blurt out the truth to Mr. Bevins and Mr. Volman. "A terrible judgment awaits you," I long to say. "Staying here, you merely delay. You are dead and shall never regain that previous place. At daybreak, when you must return to your bodies, have you not noticed their disgusting states? Do you really believe those hideous wrecks capable of bearing you anywhere ever again? And what is more, I would say, if permitted, you shall not be allowed to linger here forever. None of us shall. We are in rebellion against the will of our Lord, and in time must be broken and go. But, as instructed, I have remained silent. This is perhaps the worst of my torments. I may not tell the truth. I may speak, but never about the essential thing. Bevins and Volman consider me an arrogant, hectoring pedant, a droning old man. They roll their eyes when I offer counsel, but little do they know, my counsel is infused with bitter and excellent experience. And so I cower and stall, hiding here, knowing all the while, most dreadful, that though I remain ignorant of what sin I committed, my ledger stands just as it did on that awful day. I have done nothing to improve it since. For there is nothing to do in this place where no action can matter. Terrible. Most terrible. Is it possible that another person's experience might differ from mine? That he might proceed to some other place and have there some entirely divergent experience? Is it possible, that is, that what I saw was only a figment of my mind, my beliefs, my hopes, my secret fears? No. It was real. As real as the trees now swaying above me, as real as the pale gravel trail below, as real as the fading webbed boy breathing shallowly at my feet, banded down snugly across his chest like a captive of the wild Indians, a victim of my negligence. Lost in the above recollections, I had long ago ceased laboring on his behalf. As real as Mr. Volman and Mr. Bevins, who now came run-skimming up the path, looking happier, far happier, than I had ever before seen them. "We did it," said Volman. "We actually did it." "It was us," said Bevins. "We entered and persuaded the fellow," said Volman. Propelled by mutual joy, they vaulted in tandem onto the roof. And indeed, miracle of miracles, they had brought the gentleman back. He entered the clearing below us, holding a lock, the lock to the door of the white stone home, which, though bent in grief, he was tossing up and down in one hand like an apple. The moon shone down brightly, allowing me a first good look at his face. And what a face it was!
The nose heavy and somewhat Roman, the cheeks thin and furrowed, the skin bronzed, the lips full, the mouth wide.
In Personal Recollections of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War by James R. Gilmore.
His eyes dark gray, clear, very expressive, and varying with every mood.
In The Life of Abraham Lincoln by Isaac N. Arnold.
His eyes were bright, keen, and a luminous gray color.
In Lincoln's Photographs, a Complete Album by Lloyd Ostendorf, account of Martin P.S. Rinlob.
Gray-brown eyes, sunken under thick eyebrows, and as though encircled by deep and dark wrinkles.
In Personal Recollections of Mr. Lincoln by the Marquis de Chambrun.
His eyes were a bluish-brown.
In Herndon's Informants, edited by Douglas L. Wilson and Rodney O. Davis, account of Robert Wilson.
His eyes were bluish-gray in color, always in deep shadow, however, from the upper lids, which were unusually heavy.
In 6 months in the White House, The Story of a Picture, by F.B. Carpenter.
Kind blue eyes, over which the lids half-dropped.
In With Lincoln from Washington to Richmond in 1865 by John S. Barnes.
I would say that the eyes of President Lincoln were of bluish gray, or rather, grayish blue, for without being positive, the blue ray was always visible.
In Papers of Ruth Painter Randall, account of Edward Dalton Marchant.
The saddest eyes of any human being that I have ever seen.
In Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness, by Joshua Wolf Schenck, account of John Widmer.
None of his pictures do him the slightest justice.
In the Utica Herald.
The pictures we see of him only half represent him.
Shank Opsit, account of Orlando B. Ficklin.
In repose, it was the saddest face I ever knew. There were days when I could scarcely look at it without crying.
Carpenter Opsit.
But when he smiled or laughed.
Ostendorf Opsit, account of James Minor.
It brightened like a lit lantern when animated.
In Lincoln the Man by Don Piot, account of a journalist.
There were more differences between Lincoln Doll and Lincoln Animated in facial expression than I ever saw in any other human being.
In Wilson and Davis Opsit, account of Horace White.
His hair was dark brown, without any tendency to baldness.
In The True Story of Mary, Wife of Lincoln by Catherine Helm, account of Senator James Harlan.
His hair was black, still unmixed with gray.
In Chiefly About War Matters by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
His hair, well silvered, though the brown then predominated. His beard was more whitened.
In A Wisconsin Woman's Picture of President Lincoln by Cordelia A.P. Harvey in the Wisconsin Magazine of History.
His smile was something most lovely.
In A Recollection of the Civil War with the Leaders at Washington and in the Field in the 60s by Charles A. Dana.
His ears were large and malformed.
In Abraham Lincoln, A Medical Appraisal by Abraham M. Gordon.
When he was in a good humor, I always expected him to flap with them like a good-natured elephant.
In 10 Years of My Life by Princess Felix Salm-Salm.
His nose was not relatively oversized, but it looked large because of his thin face.
In Abraham Lincoln's Philosophy of Common Sense by Edward J. Kempf.
His nose is rather long, but he is rather long himself. So it is a necessity to keep the proportion complete.
In Mary Lincoln, Biography of a Marriage by Ruth Painter Randall, account of a soldier.
His way of laughing, too, was really funny. And such awkward gestures belonged to no other man. They attracted universal attention from the old sedate down to the schoolboy. Then, in a few minutes, he was as calm and thoughtful as a judge on the bench.
Wilson and Davis Opsit, account of Abner Ellis.
I thought him about the ugliest man I'd ever seen.
In Francis F. Brown, The Everyday Life of Abraham Lincoln, a biography of the great American president from an entirely new standpoint with fresh and invaluable material. Account of Reverend George C. Noyes.
The first time I saw Mr. Lincoln, I thought him the homeliest man I'd ever seen.
In My Day and Generation by Clark E. Carr.
The ugliest man I have ever put my eyes on.
In The Photographs of Abraham Lincoln by Frederick Hill Meserve and Carl Sandburg, account of Colonel Theodore Lyman.
The homeliest man I ever saw.
Piot Opsit.
Not only is the ugliest man I ever saw, but the most uncouth and gawky in his manners and appearance.
In Lincoln by David Herbert Donald, account of a soldier.
He was never handsome indeed, but he grew more and more cadaverous and ungainly month by month.
In Lincoln's Washington, Recollections of a Journalist Who Knew Everybody, by W. A. Crawford.
After you have been 5 minutes in his company, you cease to think that he is either homely or awkward.
In the Utica Herald.
Regarding a face and carriage so uniquely arranged by nature, one's opinion of it seemed to depend more than usual on the predisposition of the observer.
In Letters of Sam Hume, edited by Crystal Barnes.
He never appeared ugly to me, for his face, beaming with boundless kindness and benevolence towards mankind, had the stamp of intellectual beauty.
Salm-Salm Opsit.
The good humor, generosity, and intellect beaming from it makes the eye love to linger there until you almost fancy him good-looking.
In Wayside Glimpses, North and South by Lillian Foster.
The neighbors told me that I would find that Mr. Lincoln was an ugly man.
when he's really the handsomest man I ever saw in my life.
In Reminiscences of Abraham Lincoln by Distinguished Men of His Time by Alan Thorndike Rice.
I never saw a more thoughtful face. I never saw a more dignified face.
Rice, opposite. Account of David Locke.
Oh, the pathos of it. Haggard, drawn into fixed lines of unutterable sadness, with a look of loneliness, as of a soul whose depth of sorrow and bitterness no human sympathy could ever reach. The impression I carried away was that I had seen not so much the President of the United States as the saddest man in the world.
Brown, opposite.
Each motion seeming to require a terrible effort on his part, Mr. Lincoln took hold of the chain and hung the lock upon it.
The door being ajar, however, and his boy's sick form within, it seemed he could not resist making one final entry.
Vaulting down from the roof, we followed him in.
The sick form's proximity seeming to jar Mr. Lincoln loose from some prior resolution, he slid the box out of the wall slot and lowered it to the floor.
This, it seemed, was as far as he meant to go.
He had not meant even to go this far.
Except then he knelt.
Kneeling there, it seemed he could not resist opening the box one last time.
He opened it, looked in, sighed.
Reached in, tenderly rearranged the forelock.
Made a slight adjustment to the pale crossed hands.
The lad cried out from the roof.
We had forgotten about him entirely.
I stepped out, vaulted back up, worked for some time to get him free. He was in rough shape, stunned, speechless, banded down good. Then it occurred to me, if I could not pull him up, perhaps he could be pushed down. And I was quite right. He had not been impaired at all yet beneath his back. Working my hands in through the pulpy, still forming carapace, until I felt his chest, I gave him a good shove there, and down he went, with a cry of pain, through the roof, into the white stone home.
The boy came through the ceiling and landed on the floor beside his father, followed closely by Mr. Volman.
Who, from his knees, urged the boy forward. Go in, listen well, he said. You may learn something useful. We have recently heard your father express a certain wish, said Mr. Bevins. Of where he hopes you are, said Mr. Volman. In some bright place, said Mr. Bevins. Free of suffering, said Mr. Volman. Resplendent in a new mode of being, said Mr. Bevins. Go in, said Mr. Volman. Be thus guided, said Mr. Bevins. See what he would have you do.
The lad got weakly to his feet,
greatly compromised by his affliction.
In the gait of an old man, he hobbled toward his father.
He had not entered the man intentionally before, but inadvertently,
and seemed reluctant to do so now.
64.
All this time the crowd had been reassembling around the white stone home.
Word of this second visitation having spread rapidly.
With more individuals arriving every moment.
Such was their eagerness to be in attendance at this extraordinary event.
All craved the slightest participation in the transformative moment that must be imminent.
They had abandoned any pretext of speaking one at a time, many calling out desperately from where they stood, others darting brazenly up to the open door to shout their story in.
The result was cacophony.
65.
It was me started that fire.
Andy Thorne.
I steal every chance I get.
Janice P. Dwightson.
I give her diamonds and pearls and broke the hearts of wife and children and sell the house from under us to buy more diamonds and pearls, but she throws me over for Mr. Holifen with his big yellow laughing horse teeth and huge preceding paunch?
Robert G. Twistings.
60 acres with a good return, and a pen full of hog, and 30 head cattle, and 6 fine horses, and a cobbled stone house, snug as a cradle in winter, and a fine wife who looks adoringly at me, and 3 fine boys who hang on my every word, and a fine orchard giving pears, apples, plums, peaches. And still, Father don't care for me.
Lance Durning.
One thing I don't like is I am dumb. Everyone treats me like I am dumb all my life, and I am dumb. Even sewing for me is a hard one. My aunt who raised me sat hours showing me sewing. Do it like this, hon, she would say. And I would. Once. The next time I needed to do it that way, I would just sit there, needle raised. And auntie would say, Lord, child, this is the 9,000,000th time I'm showing you this. Whatever it was. See, now I can't remember what it was. What auntie showed me that I forgot. When a young man come a-courting, he would say something such as about the government, and I would say, oh, yes, the government. My aunt's teaching me to sew. And his face would go blank. Who would want to hold or love one so dull? Unless she is fair, which I am not. Just plain. Soon I am too old for the young men to come and be bored, and that is that. And my teeth go yellow and some fall out. But even when you are a solitary older lady, it is no treat to be dumb. Always at a party or so on, you are left to sit by the fire, smiling as if happy, knowing none desire to speak with you.
Miss Tamara Doolittle.
Lugged 70-pound pipe lengths up Swat Hill. Come home, hands torn to hell and bleeding. Rolled gravel 19 hours straight. And look how I am rewarded. Edna and girls shuffling in and out, gowns stained, attending me. Always worked hard, worked cheerful. And once I am better, we'll get right back at it. Only my left boot needs resoled and need to collect what Doherty owes me. Edna knows not of it, and it will go uncollected, I fear. It is much needed just now, as I cannot work. If you could kindly inform Edna, so she may collect, it is much needed just now, as I am ill and abed, and of little use to them.
Tobin Badger Muller.
Mr. Johns Melbourne did take me to a remote part of the manse and touch me in an evil way. I was just a boy, and he an eminence. Not a word of protest did I. Could I? Speak. Ever. To anyone. I should like to speak of it now. I should like to speak of it and speak of...
Vesper Johannes.
Mr. DeCroy and Professor Bloomer came blundering up, shouldering Mr. Johannes rudely aside, lurching bumpily up into the doorway, conjoined at the hip from their many years of mutual flattery.
In my time, I made many discoveries previously unknown in the scientific pantheon for which I was never properly credited. Have I mentioned how dull my peers were? My research dwarfed theirs in importance. Yet they believe their research dwarfed mine. I was regarded by them as a minor figure, when I knew very well I was quite major. I produced 18 distinct brilliant tomes, each breaking entirely new ground on such topics as... Many apologies. I find myself temporarily unable to recall my exact area of study. I do, however, recall that final ignominy when, after my departure, and before I was propelled here, as I lingered, agitated in that familiar maple, my house was emptied and my papers lugged into a vacant lot and...
Professor Edmund Bloomer.
Don't get worked up, sir. When you lurch about like that, it pains me at our juncture.
Lawrence T. DeCroy.
And burned.
My brilliant unpublished tomes were burned.
There, there. Oh, do you know what became of my pickle factory? Not to change the subject. It stands. Of that, at least, I'm proud. Although pickles are no longer made there. It is now some sort of boat-building establishment. And the name of DeCroy Pickles has been all but...
So unfair. My work, my groundbreaking work, went up in a cloud of...
I feel that way, too, you know, about my factory. It was so vital in its day. The morning whistle would sound, and from the surrounding houses would pour my 700 loyal...
Thank you for agreeing it was so unfair. Not many are so keenly discriminating, so intuitively sympathetic to my work. I believe you would have recognized me for the great man I was. If only we had met. If only you had been the editor of one of the premier scientific journals of my day, you could have published my work and seen that I got my due. At any rate, I thank you from the heart for acknowledging that I was the foremost thinker of my time. I feel some measure of redemption, having been at last recognized as the finest mind of my generation.
Say, did you ever taste one of my pickles? If you ate a pickle in the Washington area during the early part of the century, the odds are good it was a DeCroy Ferocious.
The jars had a red and yellow label, as I recall, and upon each, a drawing of a wolverine in a waistcoat?
Yes, those were my pickles. Did you think they were good?
Very good.
Thank you so much for saying my pickles were excellent. Thanks for saying that of all the pickles being made in the nation at that time, mine were by far the best.
They were, like my work, the greatest in the world at that time. Wouldn't you say? Can we agree upon that point?
I believe we can. I believe we have on many prior occasions.
I hope that soon you will again remind me of how much you thought of my work. I find it touching that you admire me so, and perhaps someday soon I will again remark upon how fine your pickles were, if that would please you. I would be happy to do so. You are worth it. You, who are so loyal and admire me so much.
Strange, isn't it? To have dedicated one's life to a certain venture, neglecting other aspects of one's life, only to have that venture in the end amount to nothing at all? The products of one's labors utterly forgotten?
Fortunately, that does not pertain to us, as we have, once again, reminded ourselves, our considerable accomplishments live on.
The barons now charged the doorway, bursting between the two men, briefly severing their conjoinment.
Ouch!
Say, that stings!
Upon the separation, and again upon the rejoining.
Sir? Rev?
We didn't get to finish.
You rushed us off. Before?
So?
As I was saying, fuck them. Those fucking ingrate snakes have no goddamn right to blame us for a fucking thing until they walk a fucking mile in our goddamn shoes. And neither fucking one of the little shitheads has walked even a shitting half mile in our fucking shoes.
Maybe we had too many parties. Maybe that's why they never come see us.
Them kids was born a shrunken old lady and a shrunken old man who didn't know the first goddamn thing about how to fucking enjoy. You know another word for party? Celebration. You know another word for celebrate? Have fucking fun. Make fucking merry. So we drank a little fucking ale, had some goddamn wine.
Touch of opium now and...
We might have sampled that fucking substance, so as not to offend... Who was it that brought that? Who started that whole...
Benjamin.
Ah, Benjamin. Benji. Remember that fucking mustache? Didn't we hold him down that once? At McMurray's? Shave him bald?
I once made the beast with Benji.
Ah, who didn't? No, although I personally never made the fucking beast with Benji, as far as I remember. Still, there were times when, among the general, hilarity... It got a little fucking unclear just who was making the goddamn beast with.
Then from among that multitude came a tremendous shout.
An unhappy murmur arose.
And many people began shouting, saying no, no, it was not appropriate, demanding that the darkies...
Black beasts!
Damnable savages!
Return at once from whence they had come.
It was a momentous occasion, and they must not spoil it.
Let them have their chance, someone cried from the throng. In this place we are all the same. Speak for yourself, someone else shouted, and we heard the sound of blows.
But several men and women of the sable hue, having boldly followed the barons over from the mass grave on the other side of the fence,
were not to be dissuaded,
and would, it seemed, have their say.
66.
I did always try, in all my aspects, to hew to elevation, to dispense therewith into myself those higher virtues of which, rendered without, one verily may sag, and dwelling there in one's misfortune, what avails?
Elson Farwell.
What the fuck is he saying?
Say it more simple, Elson, so they can fucking follow you.
Born to an unlucky fate, perforce, what attraction, if saddling sad fate unremorsed, I only succumbed, but rather was instead always happy to have loaded upon me any fulsome burdens, never dismaying those febrile opportunities to better oneself, such as books, which I many minutes stole from, abjectly accruing ample notes, on pages gleaned from Mr. East's discard, to wit, find out and spelunk what was best and most beaming in my soul, such as clean linens, gentle motions as in the dance, shimmering forks held high in mid-conversation while emitting a jolly, whinnying laugh.
The sweetest fucker, but talks so goddamn complicated.
His hip in our pit is right against my hip.
His ass rests right here, against my shoulder.
We don't mind, he's our friend.
He's one of them, but he's still our friend.
Always polite.
Knows his place.
Exeunting myself to those higher latitudes would, I felt, vault to the fore my more shining aspects. And soon enough, ran my hopes, the Easts, heartily discussing my prospects in some room of constant gleam, would decide thereunto to promote me to the house. And instantly, my suffering, which had gauged, gnawed, and vexed, bechiding with soothe my loftish sensitivities, would be converted, and, gladsome shouting, a midway I would obtain that life which, more tender, i.e. less bashing, more kind-like smiles, would,
assuage.
He always forgets assuage right there.
Assuage, yes. Would assuage my previous unhappiness.
Now watch.
Madder he gets, better he talks.
But alas, as it turned out, my previous unhappiness was not assuaged. Far from it. One day we were taken out of Washington to the country for the fireworks. Falling ill, I stumbled along the trail and could not get up, and the sun burning down brightly, how I writhed upon the,
How you writhed upon the trail, and yet no one came.
How I writhed upon the trail, and yet no one came. Until finally, the youngest East child, Reginald, passed and inquired, Elson, are you ill? And I said that I was, very much so. And he said he would send someone back for me at once. But no one came. Mr. East did not come. Mrs. East did not come. None of the other East children came. Not even Mr. Chasterly, our brutal, smirking overseer, ever came. I believe Reginald may have, in all the excitement about the fireworks, forgotten. Forgotten about me, who had known him since his birth. And lying there, it... Drat.
Lying there, it occurred to you. With the force of revelation.
Lying there, it occurred to me with the force of revelation that I, Elson Farwell, best boy, fondest son of my mother, had been sorely tricked. And colorful rockets now bursting overhead into such shapes as Old Glory and a walking chicken and a green gold comet. As if to celebrate the joke being played upon me, each new explosion eliciting fresh cries of delight from those fat, spoiled East children. I regretted every moment of conciliation and smiling and convivial waiting and longed with all my heart there in the dappled tree moonshade that in my final moments became all shade, that my health might be restored to me if just for 1 hour, so that I might correct my grand error and enstrip myself of all cowering and false talk and preening diction and rise up even yet and stride back to those always happy Easts and club and knife and rend and destroy them and tear down that tent and burn down that house and thus secure for myself,
a certain modicum of humanity, for only a beast.
A certain modicum of humanity, yes. For only a beast would endure what I had endured without objection. And not even a beast would conspire to put on the manners of its masters and hope thereby to be rewarded. But it was too late. It is too late. It shall ever be too late. When my absence was noted next day, they sent Mr. Chasterly back, and he, having found me, did not deem it necessary to bring me home, but contracted with a German who threw me on a cart with several others.
That damn Kraut stole half a loaf off my wife.
Nice bread, too.
Which is where we first met, Elson.
On back of that cart.
And been friends ever since.
Never will I leave here until I have had my revenge.
Well, you're not getting any fucking revenge, pal.
There's a lesson in what happened to you, Elson.
If you ain't white, don't try to be white.
If I could return to that previous place, I would avenge myself even now. Bring down the bedroom shelving on the fat head of little Reginald's. Cause the missus to break her neck upon the stairs. Cause the mister's clothes to burst into flame as he sat at her paralytic's bedside. Send a pestilence upon that house and kill all the children, even the baby who I previously very much...
Well, I must say, Elson, and pardon me for interrupting, I did not have any such harsh experiences as you have been describing. Mr. Connor and his good wife and all of their children and grandchildren were like family to me. Never was I separated from my own wife or children. We ate well, were never beaten. They had given us a small but attractive yellow cottage. It was a happy arrangement, all things considered. All men labor under some impingements on their freedom. None is absolutely at liberty. I felt for the most part, living simply an exaggerated version of any man's life. I adored my wife and our children and did what any working man would do, exactly what would benefit them and keep us all living convivially together. I.e., I endeavored to be a good and honorable servant to people who were, fortunately for us, good and honorable people themselves. Of course, there was always a moment, just as an order was given, when a small resistant voice would make itself known in the back of my mind. Then the necessary job was to ignore that voice. It was not a defiant or angry voice particularly, just that little human voice saying, you know, I wish to do what I wish to do and not what you are telling me to do. And I must say that voice was never quite silenced, although it did grow rather quiet over the years. But I must not overcomplain on this score. I had many free and happy moments. On Wednesday afternoons, for example, when I would be given 2 free hours to myself, and all day, every third Sunday, if things were not too hectic. Admittedly, my enjoyments during these respites were rather trivial, almost childish. I will walk over and talk to Red. I will go to the pond and sit a bit. I will take this path and not that. And no one could call out, Thomas, come hither, or Thomas, if you please, that tray, or Thomas, that vegetable bed needs tending. Fetch Charles and Violet and put them to work, will you, old boy? Unless, of course, such an interruption was necessary, in which case, naturally, they might indeed interrupt me, even on a Wednesday afternoon, or a Sunday, or late upon any night at all, as I was enjoying an intimate moment with my wife, or, was lost in a much-needed sleep, or was praying, or on the privy. And yet, still, I had my moments, my free, uninterrupted, discretionary moments. Strange, though, it is the memory of those moments that bothers me most. The thought specifically that other men enjoyed whole lifetimes comprised of such moments.
Thomas Havens.
How came you to reside in our pit, sir?
I was in town on an errand. I experienced a pain in my chest and...
Did they not seek you?
Oh, they sought me mightily. They seek me still, I am sure. But my wife leading the effort, Mr. and Mrs. Connor showing their full support. It is just they have not found me yet.
This fellow was crisply shoved aside by a young mulatto woman in a white smock and a blue-trimmed lace bonnet, trembling wildly, of such startling beauty that a low murmur rose amongst the white supplicants.
Go ahead, Litzy. It's now or fucking never.
Litzy right.
Silent.
As always.
What the fuck must have been done to her? To shut her up so tight.
Stepping up beside the mulatto came a stout Negro woman of some years, by all appearances a large, outwardly jolly presence in that previous place, who was not jolly at all now, but livid and scowling. And her feet, worn to nubs, left two trails of blood behind her, and as she placed her hands, also worked to nubs, on the mulatto's hips, in support, she left bloody prints in two places there on the pale smock, as the mulatto continued to thrum and shake.
What was done to her was done to her many times, by many. What was done to her could not be resisted, was not resisted, sometimes was resisted, which resulted sometimes in her being sent away to some far worse place. Other times in that resistance, simply being forcibly overcome, by fist, knee, board strike, etc. What was done to her was done and done, or just done once. What was done to her affected her not at all, affected her very much. Drove her to the nervous shakes, drove her to hateful speech, drove her to leap off the Cedar Creek Bridge, drove her to this obstinate silence. What was done to her was done by big men, small men, boss men, men who happened to be passing the field in which she worked, the teen sons of the boss man or the men who happened to be passing. A trio of men on a bender who spilled out of the house and just before departing saw her there, chopping wood. What was done to her was done on a regular schedule, like some sort of sinister church going. Was done to her at random times. Was never done at all, never once, but only constantly threatened, looming, and sanctioned. What was done to her was straightforward, missionary fucking. What was done to her was anal fucking, when the poor dear had never even heard of such a thing. What was done to her were small, sick things, to the accompaniment of harsh words from stunted countrymen who would never have dreamed of doing such things to a woman of their own race. Done to her, as if no one else were there, only him, the man, doing it. She nothing more than a warm, silent wax figure. What was done to her was whatever anyone wished to do. And even if someone wished only slightly to do something to her, well, one could do it. It could be done. One did it. It was done. It was done. And done. And...
Mrs. Francis Hodge.
Lieutenant Stone shouting, "Back, Shards! Get ye back!" double-timed up at the head of a group of burly white men, Pettit, Daly, and Burns among them, who brusquely cleared the black supplicants away from the white stone home, pushing at them with fallen tree limbs held horizontally at chest height.
Cries of outrage sounded forth from the black contingent.
"Ah," said Mr. Havens. "Here? As there?
Not so fucking rough."
"We know them. They're all right."
Pettit, Burns, and Daly, broad red faces distorted with rage, stepped menacingly toward the barons, causing that couple to recede meekly into the crowd.
Upon a signal from Lieutenant Stone, the patrol now drove forward, pinning the black contingent against the dreaded iron fence.
Which was not particularly dreadful to them, as it only exerted its noxious effects on those of us who resided within its limits.
Hence a standoff resulted. Lieutenant Stone and patrol, from nausea, could not advance close enough to drive the black contingent over the fence, and those individuals, having reached the limit of their willingness to submit to such depredations, continued to hold their position on this side.
Meanwhile, dozens of white supplicants rushed opportunistically into the space thus cleared before the white stone home, bellowing their stories into the doorway until it was impossible to discern any individual voice amid the desperate chorus.
67.
Mr. Lincoln heard none of this, of course. To him, it was just a silent crypt in the dead of night.
Now came the critical moment.
Boy and father must interact.
This interaction must enlighten the boy, must permit or encourage him to go.
Or all was lost.
"Why do you delay?" Mr. Volman said to the boy.
The lad drew a deep breath, prepared, it seemed, to enter, finally, and be instructed.
68.
Only then, bad luck.
A lantern light appeared in the darkness.
Mr. Manders, the night watchman.
Who approached looking as he always looks when among us, timorous, somewhat bemused by his own timorousness, eager to return to the guardhouse.
We were fond of Manders, who kept his courage up on these rounds by calling out to us congenially, assuring us that things out there were as they had been, i.e., eating, loving, brawling, births, binges, grudges, all still proceeded apace. Some nights he would mention his children.
Philip, Mary, Jack.
And tell us how they were doing.
We appreciated these reports rather more than might be expected, given the facetious spirit in which they were delivered.
As he came tonight, he called for a Mr. Lincoln, now and then amending that form of address to Mr. President.
Though we were fond of Manders,
his timing was terrible.
Awful.
The worst.
He calls for my father, said the boy, who still stood weakly against the doorside wall. Your father is president, the Reverend inquired wryly. He is, the boy said. Of, the Reverend asked. The United States, the boy said. It is true, I said to the Reverend. He is president. Much time has passed. There is a state called Minnesota. We are at war, said Mr. Volman, at war with ourselves. The cannons are greatly improved. Soldiers bivouac within the Capitol, I said. We saw it all, said Mr. Volman, when we were there within him, I said.
Mr. Manders stepped through the doorway, lantern blazing in that confined space.
What had been dark was now brightly lit. We could discern the nicks and divots in the stone walls and the wrinkles in Mr. Lincoln's coat.
The pale, sunken features of the lad's sick form.
As it lay there within the
sick box.
Ah, Manders said, here you are, sir. Yes, Mr. Lincoln said. Terribly sorry to intrude, Manders said. I thought you might require a light for the walk back. Getting rather lengthily to his feet, Mr. Lincoln shook Manders' hand.
Seeming ill at ease.
Embarrassed, perhaps, to be found here.
kneeling in front of his son's sick box.
Open sick box.
Mr. Mander's eyes involuntarily drifted past Mr. Lincoln to the contents.
Mr. Lincoln inquired as to how, without his light, Mr. Manders would find his way back. Mr. Manders said that though he preferred the light, being somewhat squeamish, still he knew this place like the back of his hand. Mr. Lincoln offered that if Mr. Manders would give him just a moment more, they might return together. Mr. Manders acceded and stepped outside.
A catastrophe.
They had not interacted at all.
Nothing had yet occurred that might benefit the boy.
Still, the lad did not come forward.
But only continued to lean against the wall, frozen by fear.
But then we saw that it was not fear at all. The wall behind him had liquefied, and tendrils had come forth, and four or five now encircled his waist, a hideous, crawling belt holding him fast.
We needed time to get him free.
Must somehow delay the gentleman's departure.
I looked at Mr. Bevins. He looked at me.
We saw what must be done.
We had the power to persuade.
Had done it, even within the hour.
Mr. Bevins was younger, possessed of multiple, very strong arms, whereas I, naked and constantly interfered with by my massive disability, was not well suited to the strenuous labor that would be required to free the lad. So in I went, into Mr. Lincoln, alone.
69.
And Lord, the fellow was low. He was attempting to formulate a goodbye, in some sort of positive spirit, not wishing to enact that final departure in gloom, in case it might be felt, somehow, by the lad. Even as he told himself that the lad was now past all feeling. But all within him was sadness, guilt, and regret, and he could find little else. So he lingered, hoping for some comforting notion to arise, upon which he might expand. But nothing came. Lo, colder than before, and sadder. And when he directed his mind outward, seeking the comfort of his life out there, and the encouragement of his future prospects, and the high regard in which he was held, no comfort was forthcoming. But on the contrary, he was not, it seemed, well thought of, or succeeding in much of anything at all.
70.
As the dead piled up in unimaginable numbers and sorrow was added to sorrow, a nation that had known little of sacrifice blamed Lincoln for a dithering mismanagement of the war effort.
In The Unpopular Mr. Lincoln, the story of America's most reviled president by Larry Tagg.
The president is an idiot.
In The Civil War Papers of George B. McClellan, edited by Stephen Sears.
Vain, weak, puerile, hypocritical, without manners, without social grace, and as he talks to you, punches his fists under your ribs.
In The War Years by Carl Sandburg, account of Sherrard Clemens.
Evidently a person of very inferior cast of character, wholly unequal to the crisis.
In The Emergence of Lincoln, Prologue to the Civil War, 1859-1861, by Alan Nevins. Account of Edward Everett.
His speeches have fallen like a wet blanket here. They put to flight all notions of greatness.
Tag opposite. Account of Congressman Charles Francis Adams.
By all odds, the weakest man who has ever been elected.
Clemens opposite.
Will go down to posterity as the man who could not read the signs of the times, nor understand the circumstances and interests of his country, who had no political aptitude, who plunged his country into a great war without a plan, who failed without excuse, and fell without a friend.
Tag Opposite, from the London Morning Post.
The people have, for 19 months, poured out, at your call, sons, brothers, husbands, and money. What is the result? Do you ever realize that the desolation, sorrow, grief that pervades this country is owing to you? That the young men who have been maimed, crippled, murdered, and made invalids for life owe it to your weakness, irresolution, and want of moral courage?
Tag Opposite, letter from S.W. Oakey.
The money flows out. Tens of thousands of men wait, are rearranged to no purpose, march pointlessly over expensive bridges thrown up for the occasion, march back across the same bridges, which are then torn down, and nothing whatsoever is accomplished.
In Letters of a Union Fellow by Tobian Clearly.
If you don't resign, we are going to put a spider in your dumpling and play the devil with you, you god or mighty goddamn son of a bith. Go to hell and bust my ass, suck my prick, and call my bollocks your uncle, dick, goddamn a fool, and goddamn Abe Lincoln. Who would like you? Goddamn you! Excuse me for using such hard words with you, but you need it. You are nothing but a goddamn black nigger.
In Dear Mr. Lincoln, edited by Harold Holzer.
If my wife wishes to leave me, may I compel her at arms to stay in our union? Especially when she is a fiercer fighter than I, better organized, quite determined to be free of me.
In Voices of a Divided Land, edited by Baines and Edgar, account of P. Mallon.
Line up the corpses. Walk from end to end. Look upon each father, husband, brother, son. Total up the cost that way, and think, as our military men, quizzed upon this confidentially, all do, that this grim line of ruined futures is only the beginning of the tidal wave of young death that must soon befall us.
In the Allentown Field Gazette.
Peace, sir, make peace, the cry of man since at least our Savior's time. Why ignore it now? Blessed are the peacemakers, the scriptures say, and we must assume the converse also to be true. Cursed are the warmongers, however just, they believe their cause.
In the Cleveland Truth Sentinel.
We did not and will not agree to fight for the nigger, for whom we do not give a whit.
In Forgotten Voices of the Civil War, edited by J.B. Strait, letter from a New York infantryman to Lincoln.
You have seized the reins, made yourself dictator, established a monolithic new form of government which must dominate over the rights of the individual. Your reign presages a terrible time when all of our liberties shall be lost in favor of the rights of the monolith. The founders look on in dismay.
In The Villain Lincoln by R.B. Arnolds, account of Daryl Cumberland.
So we have the dilemma put to us. What to do when his power must continue 2 years longer, and when the existence of our country may be endangered before he can be replaced by a man of sense? How hard, in order to save the country, to sustain a man who is incompetent.
In Lincoln Reconsidered by David Herbert Donald, letter from George Bancroft to Francis Lieber.
If Abe Lincoln should be reelected for another term of 4 years of such wretched administration, we hope that a bold hand will be found to plunge the dagger into the tyrant's heart for the public welfare.
In the La Crosse Democrat.
Old Abe Lincoln, goddamn your goddamned old hellfire goddamned soul to hell, goddamn you, and goddamn your goddamned family's goddamned hellfire goddamned soul to hell, and goddamn nation, goddamn them, and goddamn your goddamned friends to hell, goddamn their goddamned souls to damnation, goddamn them.
Holzer, Opposite.
Well, what of it? No one who has ever done anything worth doing has gone uncriticized. As regards the matter at hand, as regards him, I am, at least, above any. Thus thought Mr. Lincoln. But then his hour, eyes shut, in a slow remembering sorrow wince.
Harsh whispers made the rounds in those dreadful days, intimating that all that would have been needed to spare the boy's life was the basic restraining influence of a parent.
In The Prairie Torment, Lincoln's Psychology by James Spicer.
Willie was so delighted with the little pony that he insisted on riding it every day. The weather was changeable, and exposure resulted in a severe cold, which deepened into fever.
Keckley opposite.
Why, some asked, was a child riding a pony about in the pouring rain without a coat?
Spicer opposite.
Those of us who knew the Lincoln children personally and saw them running around the White House like a pair of wild savages will attest to the fact that this was a household in a state of perpetual bedlam, where indiscriminate permission was confused with filial love.
In Accidental Jehovah, Will Focus and the Great Deed, by Kristen Tolles, account of B. Milbank.
Lincoln exercised no government of any kind over his household. His children did much as they pleased. Many of their antics he approved, and he restrained them in nothing. He never reproved them or gave them a fatherly frown.
In Life of Lincoln by William H. Herndon and Jesse W. Weick.
He always said, "It is my pleasure that my children are free, happy and unrestrained by parental tyranny. Love is the chain whereby to lock a child to its parents."
In Herndon's Informants, edited by Douglas L. Wilson and Rodney O. Davis, account of Mary Lincoln.
These children would take down the books. Empty ash buckets, coal ashes, inkstand, papers, gold, pens, letters, etc., etc., in a pile, and then dance on the pile. Lincoln would say nothing, so abstracted was he, and so blinded to his children's faults. Had they shit in Lincoln's hat and rubbed it on his boots, he would have laughed and thought it smart.
In Herndon on Lincoln, Letters, edited by Douglas L. Wilson and Rodney O. Davis, letter to Jesse K. Weick.
They could have raced past him into a shooting match, and he would not have glanced up from his work. For Lincoln, all subsequent hagiography aside, was an ambitious man, nearly monomaniacally so.
In They Knew Him, edited by Leonora Morehouse, account of Theodore Blazgen.
Any man who thinks that Lincoln calmly gathered his robes about him, waiting for the people to call him, has a very erroneous knowledge of Lincoln. He was always calculating and always planning ahead. His ambition was a little engine that knew no rest.
In The Inner World of Abraham Lincoln by Michael Burlingame, account of William H. Herndon.
One like myself, who long ago made the decision to put aside worldly aspirations for the gentler pleasures of home and family, and to accept, as part of the bargain, a commensurately less glorious public life, can only imagine the dark cloud that must descend upon one's head at the thought of what might have happened, had all of one's attention been as appropriate on the essential hearthside matters.
In Wise Words and Collected Letters from a Grandfather, unpublished manuscript edited by Simone Grand, used by permission by Norman G. Grand.
When a child is lost, there is no end to the self-torment a parent may inflict. When we love, and the object of our love is small, weak, and vulnerable, and has looked to us and us alone for protection, and when such protection, for whatever reason, has failed, what consolation, what justification, what defense may there possibly be? None. Doubt will fester as long as we live. And when one occasion of doubt has been addressed, another, and then another, will arise in its place.
Milland, opposite.